16.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
All right, you are on the Edges broadcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you on, Peter, man. I'm telling you, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, and that is early America and the beginning of this country. Man, a lot of people, Peter Wood, are rewriting history. And I believe you put together a project to keep that history straight. What is that project?
Project is called the 1620 Project, named after the year in which the Mayflower brought the pilgrims and the strangers to New England and signed the Mayflower Compact, which is an early draft of what became the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever seen this show, but I do something called Ranting Points, and I talked about where I believe the origin of criminals came from in this country. I don't know what side of the political spectrum you're on, but I did refer to Democrats at one point. But you said the key word there was that the pilgrims referred to a certain group among them in the Mayflower as strangers. Why did they do that?
Well, the pilgrims were a small religious group of dissenters who had gone off to Holland for 10 years, and they were afraid that their children were becoming Dutch. So they decided they were going to go someplace new. They went back to England. Their ship, the Speedwell, did not fare well in the ocean, so they ended up being crammed together with a fairly large company of settlers that had been recruited by a mercantile company in London. So when they were on the high seas, about two-thirds of the 102 passengers were these secular individuals who were coming to the New World to become farmers and tradesmen and the like. To the people we call the pilgrims, they were strangers, and that's what they called them.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another group of cats that landed in 1619, and I think the New York Times did an expose on that. Tell us a little bit about what you know about the 1619 deal they wrote up about.
Well, this was in August 18th of 2019, allegedly the 400th anniversary of the arrival of another ship, the White Lion, near Jamestown, Virginia. And that ship was actually a pirate ship that had intercepted a Spanish slave ship in the Caribbean, captured some slaves, and after various vicissitudes, ended up in Virginia trading the slaves for food. Not much of the story is true. According to the New York Times, and the lead author of the New York Times' essay titled The 1619 Project, those African captives arriving in Virginia were the beginning of what the Times calls a slaveocracy in America. This was the beginning of 4 centuries of racial oppression. This was the unhappy fate of those individuals to be the founders of a legacy that goes on to this day of deprivation of rights and being suppressed and commandeered by a white majority. Unfortunately for the Times, that story doesn't quite work out the way they would want it to, because when those slaves got off the White Lion and set foot on the soil of this continent, they were no longer slaves. Virginia did not recognize slavery at that time, so these individuals were assimilated as indentured servants, as were many of the other residents of Jamestown that had come from England. The difference between a slave and an indentured servant is pretty significant. A slave is usually a slave for life. The children of a slave are a slave, and so on. And slaves typically didn't have much in the way of legal rights. The indentured servants did have legal rights, and their term of service was limited to a few years, after which, in this case, they became free men and women. In the case of these 20-some individuals who got off the White Lion, they became landowners. They intermarried with the white population. In one case that we know about, one of them sued a white neighbor and won in Virginia court, so we have pretty good evidence that there were no legal bars to their full citizenship in that state. Mm-hmm. So whatever else happened here, it's not a very good place to tell the story of how slavery became an institution in the New World. Mm-hmm. We could talk more about that. Basically, my argument is that if you're looking for an origin story, how did America become America, we do a lot better by paying attention to what happened in November 1620 than you do by focusing on what happened in August 1619.
Mm-hmm. Now, originally, the strangers, this is the way I understand it, that they were originally, the Mayflower was supposed to go to the Virginia colony, but it didn't, and therefore the stranger said, we're not going to be under any law here because we agreed to be under the law there, which was under the king. And is that why they came up and they had to develop the Mayflower Compact?
In a word, yes. They expected to go to Northern Virginia. Most scholars now, they think they were probably headed towards Manhattan. But the strangers, this company of people recruited to work in the New World, indeed thought, okay, the law under which we signed that contract's null and void. There's nobody here to enforce it, so we're going to go our own way. The religious group, the pilgrims, said, no, this is not a great idea. We're arriving at the onset of winter in a landscape that none of us know. We are basically out of food. And what kind of reception we'll get from the native inhabitants, who knows? So on November 11th, they anchored off what's now Provincetown, Massachusetts, and they debated and ended up with this very short agreement. It's about a little less than 200 words long, in which both sides agreed to establish a civil body politic. I know it's not a familiar phrase these mm-hmm. days, but what they meant was that they were going to be self-governing. They'd elect their own leaders, they'd establish their own laws, they were going to make disappear, for any legal purposes, the differences between the pilgrims and the strangers. They were going to abolish most ideas of hierarchy, the servants as well as the masters in this group of people signed the document. And once they were on shore, it was pretty clear that a principle of equality was going to override all the ideas of social distinction and hierarchy that mm-hmm, had been in mm-hmm, place mm-hmm. back in England.
There's a mad rush to take down a lot of statues that the people are trying to, I guess it appears that nobody knows anything about history. So they're rewriting history, and they're saying that the history that you've heard of isn't correct. But do you feel like there's a larger, I don't want to say conspiracy, but let's just use the word. Why not? I don't mind throwing that word out. That's what I do. Is there a larger conspiracy to undermine the United States as a country itself, to say merge it into a new world order type of situation?
Well, I think in general there is such a conspiracy, or at least a movement that owns that idea, and the New York Times' 1619 Project is very definitely part of it. The purpose of the 1619 Project is to declare that American society is illegitimate. As one of the authors of it puts it, that the ideals on which we were founded were false when they were written. And it's a somewhat awkward way to put it, but what she, that's Hannah Nicole Jones, means is that when we talk about liberty or freedom, when we talk about equality, we don't mean it. We never did. This was all just a mask put there to make people be complacent while their rights were being taken away from them. A conspiracy, yes. This is an attempt to essentially make people hate their own country. Mm-hmm. And it isn't according to the only such attempt. There are many attempts that have been going on for quite some time. The way in which the 1619 Project took hold like a prairie fire in this country was that people were already softened up to this idea that America really isn't a very good place and we should look back on our history not with pride but with shame. Mm-hmm. So that's what this project is about, and that's why I'm resisting it.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the National Association of Scholars, do they have that's your website there, and I have screenshots of it going up. But is that do they have similar views? Or do they each take sort of the contributors you have there? Do they take different topics and address them, or how is that all working?
Well, we're an organization of about 3,400 members, most of whom are academics of one sort or another, though we don't require that. And I would say we have been characterized fairly as a right of center group. Our members may have distinct ideas on all sorts of topics themselves, but to the extent that they want to be members of the National Association of Scholars, they are allowing that their views are probably pretty conservative.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I look at history and I think about the Pilgrims and the Puritans, for that matter, I wonder, as they sought freedom and freedom to worship as they choose, and they try to do things right, basically from a biblical standpoint, as well as a moral standpoint, what would their view of the United States be today? Have you ever gone down the road to think of how they would view what's going on?
Well, actually, I have given a little bit of thought to that. I would say that their first impression would be astonishment that things could have gotten as bad as they are. But on second thought, there being people who believe that this is a fallen world we live in and that temptations to sin are always around us, they probably would conclude that they had been early visitors to a nation that arose in their wake that had turned against their own foundational principles. Mm-hmm. If they hung around long enough to observe a little bit further, however, they might take heart in that they would find that the decadent society that they first saw has still behind it a very substantial number of people who still believe in God, that still believe in the pursuit of truth and freedom and liberty are still ideals, so is equality. The notion that this could be an exemplary nation might have failed, but it's the fact is that many Americans still believe that to be true and still strive to make it true.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a mixed verdict here. I would say they'd be disappointed, but they might in the end see that there's some good that came out of it anyway.
There's some scripture in the Bible that talks about girding up your loins. And I think the reason I think this is a great topic because we're going all the way back, because everything in this country is under review right now. And half the country is against the other half. It's a complete kind of mess there. But I think for the people that believe in this country and the Constitution, the part of the girding up of the loins would be to go back and see how we started. Because I think when you're going to a battle, you need to know what you're fighting for and what people before you came and fought for to allow you to be where you're at. So going back to as far as we can go, I mean, basically the 1620 Project to me is a great starting point because that's where civilizations tried to grab, get root in this country and have it create a freer, fairer, can I say that word?
Yes.
Civilization, you know, and so people need to know what we're fighting for. Now, the Pilgrims, of course, they were 60 some days going across the ocean there. When they landed, they were just, there was nothing there where they landed. They were surrounded by Indians. They didn't know what to do and they're in the wrong place. They could have gave up. They could have said, and some did. Some, I think some of them wanted to stay on the ship, and that ship was anchored, the Mayflower was anchored out there for a while, right?
Yeah.
And they would go out, it's like a mile out, and they would go back and forth. Some of them didn't want to come back. They didn't want to go back to land. They didn't want to go back to England. But others, through great loss of the people that went there, the original people that landed, half of them died. But they persevered. And so here we are today, 2020, we're crossing a great ocean. And that great is a great ocean of division. It's a great ocean of evil. But we've got to keep going. Yeah, some of us are going to be destroyed along the way. Some of us are going to lose businesses and these kinds of things. But we've got to press on just like they did. That American spirit, I believe, Peter Wood, is still in our DNA. What say you?
I say that it's there. I agree with you. We're a stubborn people when it comes to fundamental pursuit of what's right. And we are now faced with a challenge. I mean, I suppose every generation gets a special challenge of its own. In this case, we now face a movement that has made rapid progress towards destroying the country and would love nothing more than to take full power and force its will on all the rest. We're at a moment of uncertainty. We can't predict exactly how Americans will respond to this challenge, but like you, I think that we're made of tough stuff. And if you do go back to our history, we see that toughness emerging again and again. To think of those 102 people who got across the ocean on the Mayflower, and 45 of them, I think, is the number, who died during that first incredibly harsh winter they endured, but they didn't give up. They could have gone back. There was a ship that, well, the Mayflower itself returned to England in March of 1621, but later on in the year, another ship arrived from England. So they had the opportunity to escape if they were going to, but they didn't take it. In fact, some of the sailors that the crew of the Mayflower, who weren't among the 102, decided that they would stay also in the New World. So there was something inspiring about this determination to soldier on despite all the incredible hardships they endured.
Through the years, many adversaries of the United States took America for granted in that they considered that we didn't have the will or stomach to fight. And in most cases in American history, they were sadly mistaken. Pearl Harbor is one thing I can point to various times. And I think now, today, people are making the same mistake that we love our, you know, we want to watch football and we got to have health care and, you know, we got to have all these niceties. And as long as we have them, that we'll just placate those that are slowly putting us in the water like a boiling frog. But I think the frogs jumped out of the water by now and realized that water was an attempt to kill us. And so I think we're being underestimated again. People forever, Peter Wood, have been sort of taught, going back to the public schools, that, you know, you sort of respect the authorities and they didn't really bring religion into it, at least in the last 50 years, I guess. But, you know, respect authorities and the law is the law and these kinds of things. But now we're finding out that the people in charge have been duping us and have been manipulating us to such an extent we had no idea. So we never got to the sort of the resistant stage to where we would resist. I mean, I'm sure the pilgrims, when they were in England, they didn't just say, hey, let's go sailing across the country. In fact, what did they go to Holland first, was it?
They were in Holland for 10 years before they went to...
And you probably know this because you're the historical expert, but the European war started breaking out and they considered that Armageddon was beginning to happen. And so they need to go further and they wanted to get off the continent. I think they went back to England, they got a sponsor, and then they left. But they had a motivation there. They thought it was over then. As people may be thinking it's over now. It's not over, and it's never over. But I think we're being underestimated because we never got to the point where we are, to where we see such evil that I don't think people are so much relying on the government to take care of them, because the government is intrinsically corrupt, and they've been working against us all this time. But they've never faced the wrath. What I'm trying to say is they've never actually faced the wrath of resistance from the people.
They haven't in any recent time. I think we've got, this diverts into a topic I wasn't especially looking to talk about this evening, but I'm happy to, which is that we've got both this domestic problem, the deep state or whatever you want to call it, of people who are in love with power and want to keep it or extend it, and intend us to ride roughshod over the rest of us. And we have the problem of China, which is one of those foreign powers that really does seem to think that it's taken our measure, knows that we're soft and weak, and that we can be steamrolled, or in the case of some of our legislators, seduced by pretty women and then, you know, taken advantage of in these raw ways. Well, you know, both those things are happening. And the deep state folks seem to be perfectly happy to see China eat our lunch. So I think that that's the lineup. We're facing enemies, domestic and foreign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree with you. And really, I see a direct connection back to 1620. I'm just saying that we need to place our foot firmly on the foundation that those pilgrims built for us and their motivations, and put our foot firmly there as we move forward. We need to know the actual true history so that we know what we're fighting for. You know, I think the guys in World War II, they had to know what they were fighting for. They were fighting for mom and pop and American women, for that matter, you know, back at home. But they believed in America, they believed in the Constitution, they believed in the Bible, and they went and they fought for it, and they won victories. And I think that's part of the enemy's process, is to get us away. That's why this COVID lockdown is so against people gathering in churches. Because if people gathering in churches like they did, like the Minutemen did, when they would gather, they'd sing the prayers and the hymns, and then they would load their muskets and be ready to fight the British within a minute. That was the call. So the religious motivation is abhorrent to the forces that are trying to destroy this country, and I'm pretty sure that's why they're so against people gathering together.
I think that's very much the truth. The religion is a force outside the control of government. Every government seems to want to control it or take it over, but I think what we've got now is the secular part of the population, the part of the population that either doesn't believe in God or regards it as something of no urgency in their lives, are attracted to things that are sort of like religion but aren't really, like turning global warming into a belief system, or the sort of whole climate craziness that is a instrument of keeping people fearful. It's part of what's happened with the spread of this COVID-19 disease. It's been turned into a weapon to take people out of their churches and out of public life generally.
Isn't it interesting, I guess we could use the word non-religious, secular, godless, heathens, whatever, strangers. They all have benefited on the foundation that the religious pilgrims and the Puritans put forth. As they dedicated, all the major universities were dedicated for the furtherance of the gospel of Jesus Christ, all of them. But from there, the foundation was built to build this mighty country. They're all benefiting from that, because those of us that have morals and checks and balances, say, that are biblically based or religious based, have kept this country together so that people aren't robbing banks and people aren't killing each other, people aren't stealing, people aren't shooting each other. But the more that's drawn away from, of course, the opposite happens. It seems like humans divert to their lowest common denominator. But they've all benefited on a stable society that was built by the religious. The godless didn't do that. They were along for the ride. In the very beginning, it was the religious people that put this country together and set it in its motion. The set of laws based on all the way back to the Magna Carta, to the Compact, to the Constitution, to the Bill of Rights. All this was from, as Washington would call, a religious people. You know, one of the three pillars that holds the glue of this country together. You know, so, but they've all benefited from it. They have no idea really what they want. And none of them can tell you what they want, or see the end of what they want, because the end of what they want is destruction and anarchy, and nobody can live there.
Well, I live and work in New York most of the time, although I'm talking to you from Vermont right now. In New York, I witness every day people who enter the subway by jumping the turnstile. I tend to view the secular population as a population of turnstile jumpers. They don't make the subway work. Other people who pay the fare make the subway work. Mm-hmm. So there's this taking advantage of something that already exists and pretending that they can make it better. We see that politicians in these major cities, and in my case it's Mayor de Blasio, just shun the rule of law. They're willing to say the rules don't matter when the riots break out or people become lawless in the streets, they're willing to turn a blind eye to that, though they're not willing to turn a blind eye to religious groups holding services or funerals or weddings or things like that.
Well, Peter Wood of the National Association of Scholars, that when you're talking, it reminded me of AOC just recently. She hates capitalism, man, hates it with a passion. She wants socialism. And by the way, you can go to her website, and for only $50, you can buy a shirt that says, I hate capitalism. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, that sounds like capitalism to me.
Well,
because in socialism, she'd have to give that shirt away. So I don't think she's a true believer.
Well, I think that what you generally find on the socialist left are people who are opportunistic, and they will say one thing at one time and do the opposite as long as it benefits themselves. But they depend on there being people who can be suckered by this, who especially young people who get enthusiastic. Socialism just sounds so wonderful. Every human need will be taken care of for free, and all I need to do is sign up.
So you're saying with socialism, you got to stand in a little circle, and capitalism, you get to have a party down with 20,000 of your closest friends. By the way, we do have questions coming in for you, Peter Whistle. Let's start with this out of our live chat. We have this show is streaming in actually four different places, streaming video. And video on YouTube and video on the website and audio channels of our TuneIn radio program and our iTunes. So four different ways. But so we're getting questions in. It says, do you see a need or do you see an allied military invasion at some point with a new axis of evil, Russia, China, possibly Iran? And by the way, my Facebook today, somebody says the Chinese are massing on the southern border. And they wanted to know my opinion because I'm in the know. Of course, a cowboy, you got a hat like this, you know that I'm going to know everything. So I said, no, it's a hoax. And then next thing you know, I get another thing saying the Chinese are coming down from China. I mean, Chinese are coming down from Canada. So either coming up or they're coming down, they're everywhere. I mean, are we going to get invaded?
Not militarily. I think we've been invaded already. We've already got a lot of people in this country whether they were born here or immigrated here, who don't really view the United States as a place that they uphold and own and care about, let alone love. And that kind of invasion is a lot more serious than an invasion of tanks or people carrying laser guns or something like that. Mm-hmm. Military threats are real, but they're not being focused on our shores right now. Maybe the exception to that is Iran. If it ever did manage to get a nuclear missile, that would be something to worry about. Mm-hmm. And of course, North Korea is something to worry about. But all these nations know that we are so powerful, and at least until recently, our leaders have been willing to stand up to them, that I don't think the military invasion is the thing that we should fear most. We should fear most the subversion from within.
Yeah. You know, when you read that, said, I will protect the United States from enemies, foreign and domestic, I'm thinking, when's that going to happen? Jeez. All right. So we got this question from Azure. This is the second question from her. What country is the absolute biggest player in the monetized destruction of the American democracy?
Well, No, I'm not an expert on that, but I would venture a strong guess that it's China. But I'll have to let it go at that.
You got Fang Fang out there banging all the Democrats. But somebody on the Intelligence Committee said that there are thousands. You know who Fang Fang is? She came out recently. Eric Fartwell.
It's not a hierarchy of the Democratic left,
they said there are thousands of these Fang Fangs, honeypots across our country, and that reminds me, that goes all the way back to my boy Clinton, from the man from Hope. Okay, I remember when he sold the technology from Loral Space Technology to the Chinese, who couldn't put a missile within a mile of a target, and he allowed that technology to be sold to the Chinese, who consequently put $18 million into the Democrat caucus there, into the Democrat National Committee. I remember that, and the Cowboys don't forget. We're like elephants, okay? So they've forever been making money. Then they got this Hunter Biden deals making billions of dollars. And, you know, I mean, they put a 2.8-carat diamond under Hunter Biden's pillow. And this is one of the things the government's investigating. But, you know, they let that whole thing slide so that Joe Biden could get the nomination. That's a hoax, too. This shows you how many people are getting paid off. They say that, now you might know more than I do, but they say that a lot of our universities have been bought off by Chinese. Is that true?
Yes, that's something I can talk about with some authority. Several years ago, I got a call from one of my members in Ohio saying that his university was about to create something called a Confucius Institute. Did I know anything about them? And the answer was no, I didn't, but I made it my business to find out. And we ended up publishing a lengthy study on Confucius Institutes. What those things are an agency of the Chinese government charged with creating propaganda. It's called the Hanban, or it was until a few months ago. It just changed its name. The Hanban would approach American college university presidents and say, we've got a nice deal for you. We believe in cultural exchange. And if you will host on your campus a Confucius Institute, we will pay the full cost. We'll bring over our own teachers to teach it. And what it will do is just nice things. It's going to teach Chinese language to your students for free and show them Chinese art and stuff like that. If the president signed up for this, they get an immediate and ongoing fee, which ranged all the way up to $500,000 a year. They also got a sudden flood of Chinese students paying full tuition, which amounted to a lot more than the $500,000. Confucius Institutes were at 120, roughly, colleges when we started our study. And as we started digging into them, we found things were mighty strange. These institutes were governed under Chinese law. If there were disputes, they were settled in Chinese courts. The agreements themselves were secret by the request of the Chinese government. And those people brought over to teach in the Chinese-sponsored Confucius Institutes weren't teachers. Many of them were from the Chinese military. They were basically here to spy. Mm-hmm. And by buying favor with the administrations at these colleges and universities, they were gaining access to our taxpayer-funded research, which was being packed up in suitcases and sent back home. They were also engaged in direct surveillance of Chinese Americans and Chinese students. In every way, this was a big foreign intelligence operation that operating in the U.S., but not really in secret, with the approval and enthusiasm of many of our leaders of colleges and universities. Well, we put our report, the State Department, the FBI, eventually the White House, members of Congress stood up and took notice. So we've now reached the point where about half of these institutes have been closed, but the colleges aren't going along with that. Some of them were officially closing them and then reopening them under another name. Mm-hmm. The subversion of our universities by China is taken other forms as well. They've run something called the Thousand Talents Program, which pays subsidies to American scientists to buddy up with Chinese scientists. Well, as it turns out, they target those scientists who are in strategic areas, and off they go. Recently, the chairman of the chemistry department at Harvard University, a man named Charles Lieber, was arrested. Not on espionage, because that's awfully hard to prove, but they caught him non-reporting the hundreds of thousands of dollars that China was paying him each year. He, by the way, was doing research that pertains to how viruses work.
Well, there
and
you
his
go.
His partner was at Wuhan University. Think about that.
Wow. There's a direct connection. Didn't Didn't Britain try to undermine the colonies? And
Well,
wouldn't
in a variety of ways, the British were flooding the southern colonies with slaves at a time when most southerners said, "We have enough slaves, we don't want more." So there was that kind of undermining. But if you want a really detailed list of the ways in which Britain was undermining the colonies, it's all written down for us handily in this document we call the Declaration of Independence, which lays out in Thomas Jefferson's hand about 30 different ways in which the British government was undermining the rule of law here on this side of the Atlantic.
Well, there you go. That was foreign interference right back then, wasn't it?
It sure was.
Didn't work, did it, Peter?
Well, it didn't work, or I guess you could say it worked until it didn't work. And the point at which it didn't work is when we had Concord and Lexington and Bunker Hill and onward to Yorktown.
The kind of war that we're fighting now, I think, is sort of an information war. As you say, they're trying to rewrite history. Now, all of a sudden, Thomas Jefferson is a criminal, and they're renaming schools all across the country. They certainly want to take down or destroy, redo the Jefferson Memorial, but right now they're settling with schools. Was he a racist?
Well, was Thomas Jefferson a racist? He's the man who wrote his own words, "All men are created equal." That doesn't really sound like the
Well, I
Declaration
really
of
don't.
Races. It is true that he held slaves at Monticello, and history is not as clean-cut and nice as we might sometimes want it to be, but men live in the time in which they were born. Slavery was an established institution that surrounded him. He didn't like it, but he went along with it. His words in the Declaration of Independence inspired many generations of Americans to fight against slavery and eventually to end it. So, was he a racist? No, I think not, but I understand that he presents a complex problem of a real human being who made
Well,
decisions in difficult
how
ways.
fair is it for this woke generation to judge somebody in the past?
It's not fair at all. Let me say that we do judge people in the past, and you have to get educated to realize that that's a dangerous game to play, that people need to be understood in the context of their own times. And to invent new standards and apply them to people who lived long ago is just kind of asinine. It doesn't really tell you anything about them. All it does is come out as an exercise in preening. Look how clear-eyed and moral I am, because I can look down on people who lived 200 or 300 years ago. Well, big so what?
Teflon Hoop from the live chat says, Peter, are they trying to implement Agenda 2020 right now?
Agenda 2020, I think that's a reference to the UN's plan to eliminate local government in favor of a kind of regional government. But I may be misreading the caller's comment there. But if I'm on the right track, the answer is yes. That's what they
All
want to do.
right. Doreen asks, says, Peter, is civil war imminent in this country?
You know, if you'd asked me a couple months ago, I would have laughed at that and said no. Now, I worry that it might be. If we have a stolen election and illegitimate government take power, and we have upwards of 73 million or more people who realize that their franchise has been stripped away through manipulation of vote counts and other nefarious techniques, I don't know how the public will respond to all of that. If there's a, orders come down from the White House that get implemented by law authorities that put some of this stuff into practice, I think people will resist, and some of them will resist with force.
Well, I'm not speaking for 75 million people, but the number's probably higher than that. It's kind of like Twitter or Facebook shadow banning people. You never really know what the true number is because they're decreasing your message out there. So I'd imagine that number is tainted to begin with. But I will never look at another election like it's legit. Now, this is Indiana. We're a red state. And the election went smooth as silk, didn't have a glitch anywhere, and we didn't have any big trucks of ballots being shipped in. But all over the country, that did happen. And so I will never look at it. And now the biggest election since the election is coming up in Georgia. It has to do with the two senators, as you know. And it seems to me the same apparatus and the same people who counted the votes the first time are going to be there the second time. Is there any chance that there's going to be a legitimate election in Georgia?
Well, I think there's some chance in that the eyes of the whole nation now are focused on this. These people cheated pretty openly the first time, but now, they know that we're watching. So there's that. I'm not making a prediction that it is going to be a free and fair election in Georgia, but you're asking me if there's a chance. I think there is a chance. Yes.
And isn't that crazy? We have to have a discussion of if there's a chance of a fair election. This is where we are. So that's why I wanted to see where we came from, so I could measure where we are. That's part of the. That's I just see this whole historical thing just tied in together with that. All right, we have more questions coming in for you. Jack Stan says, Peter, how does Russia fit in the new world? Will they fall in line with China?
Well, China and Russia are traditional adversaries. They do from time to time make common cause. I think Vladimir Putin would love to weaken the United States. It's as he sees it, it's a zero-sum game. Weaken the United States benefits Russia. It does so directly in the form of allowing him to become a more dominant power in Europe. So he and China have that much in common. On the other hand, President Xi and Chinese generally look down on the Russians, and the Russians are aware of that. So there's fracture there. When we got good American government, we have leaders who know how to make sure that ominous convergence of Russia and China doesn't happen. When we have weak American government, we turn a blind eye to both, and ends up that they indeed conspire against us. So it's a hard question, but those are the play
Well,
fields.
you said it so eloquently there that if somebody would ask you, is there going to be a civil war in this country a year ago, pre-COVID, or maybe a couple of years ago, whatever, obviously I would say no. I would agree with you, no. But now here we are. We also have this other issue, which was brought up by Rush Limbaugh, and that is the word secession. Texas seems like they've been talking about for a long time, and you don't mess with Texas, and so you don't mess with people with cowboy hats either. But what do you see in that realm? Is it a possibility that certain states will say, okay, we're going to abide by the Constitution because our forefathers wrote it, and it's the best document ever in the history of the planet, and those people can destroy themselves with their anarchy? Do you think there's a possibility of secession between the states that believe in the Constitution and those that don't?
Wow. Well, I haven't been asked that question before. I'm of the view that there are a substantial number of Americans who are thinking about it right now. It's a big step to take, but let me reframe the question a little bit. If we were in a situation where the Supreme Court got packed, where two new states were added to the United States so as to ensure perpetual rule by the Democratic Party, the pressure for secession among other states would grow enormously. It's either that or face New York State and California basically deciding who's going to run the country from now and forever. So what's in it anymore for, well, you're Texas, but think of almost any state in the middle of the country. We are faced with that possibility, I think the possibility of succession becomes much more real. On the other hand, the concentration of financial and other resources in New York and California are so great that it's not a foregone conclusion that secession would work. So I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't welcome it. I would rather see a real United States with the emphasis on united come out at the end of this. But we're only going to get that if we have a rule of law. To go back to the Mayflower Compact, it worked because the Pilgrims and the Strangers decided that they would work together, and despite their differences, they were going to adhere to the rule of law. Well, we don't have that right now. We have lawlessness, and it's not going to work as a country. You can't have a country in which a substantial number of people hate the very idea of the country and want to destroy it down to rubble to create something new. The Chopped in Portland, Oregon, or Seattle, these are secession movements already, secession movements of the left, where they decide that the laws don't pertain to them anymore, and weak government authorities go along with that. Well, if you're going to have secession on the left, you're going to get it on the right, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wow. It's thrilling there. All right. Jack Stan says, given the current attempts to rewrite history, is it possible that previous history was rewritten itself?
Huh. Well, history is always being rewritten, but let's be careful as to what that means and how we use it. We have histories written in the last 20 years of the American founding that make use of documents that had been lost in the archives. There are new ways of looking at history using statistical techniques to count up data that was not easily accessible before. So, yeah, history is constantly being rewritten as our knowledge of the past gains. I'm an anthropologist by training. I've worked with archaeologists who dig things up out of the ground and learn something new. You have to rewrite the textbooks because of that. There's nothing wrong with rewriting history as long as you're rewriting it in the pursuit of truth and understanding that the history you write still has to be founded on the best evidence available. The best evidence that's available keeps changing because we learn more, we get better. That's different from rewriting history in the normal use of that phrase, where what's being rewritten is we forget facts, we decide that it's awkward or inconvenient to remember the good things that happened, and we're going to replace them with a story of nothing but tyranny and oppression.
Throughout human history, when there have been civilizations fighting against each other, the first thing they would do is take down the monuments and rewrite the history so they could eliminate their culture to undermine their dedication to that. But let me ask you something about the Supreme Court. It seems to me they only have one job, and that's to measure a law's validity against the Constitution, but particularly when it comes to the states. When a state has an grievance with another state, it seems pretty simple. That's their purview. That is exactly what they should be ruling on. But this Texas versus Pennsylvania, they just kicked it out and said, you don't have no standing. Did they have standing?
In my view, they did. Of course, I'm not a lawyer, so I can be very free with my legal opinions. They don't count for anything but my sort of bare-knuckled understanding of the realities of the matter. The Supreme Court has, in other cases, decided that one state does have a legitimate interest in due process of law in other states. There was a famous decision that it reached on this matter that pertained to whether a state could sue another state for environmental damage. And the Supreme Court said, well, yes, it could. So it turned out that they allowed that one state does have standing to sue another state. But then faced with this recent filing by the state of Texas against Pennsylvania, only two justices, Thomas and Alito, said, yeah, we should hear this case. Mm-hmm. And the other seven shrugged and walked away from it. Now, there is a best case way of reading that, which is to say that they're putting pressure on the corrupt states to clean up their act directly, mm-hmm. the legislatures in those states that allowed their attorneys general and their governors to get away with this stuff, really do need to rise to the occasion and take legal actions that are available to them.
Isn't the message now that states can rewrite, that there's no constitutional mooring at all, there's no legal mooring at all, that anybody can do as they want? Isn't that the message from the Supreme Court?
I don't see any other way to read that decision, and it's really disheartening that that's where the Supreme Court went.
To stop them from saying, instead of 3 days after the election count ballots, a month later, and anybody who can write, if each person can send in five ballots, what's to stop them from making those decisions?
It's a nullification of our electoral system. No, there's the, I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase, the Priven or Coward Priven idea. These were two far left-wing radicals who thought the best way to bring down America would be to flood the system with phony stuff and get
rules,
the welfare rules full of millions of people.
So rules for radicals is what you're referring to.
Yeah, that's a Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radical. Rules for Radicals. I think that's a large part of what the Democrats have accomplished this time around. They've made it impossible to have confidence or trust in the way we elect people, whether it's through massive numbers of absentee ballots or phony ballots or pre-rigged voting machines mm-hmm. or suppression of important stories like the Hunter Biden story, the kicking people off Facebook and Google and so on.
Now, being a historian, I'm sure you're well aware that the mail-in ballot hoax was used in the re-election for Lincoln.
Actually, I don't know that. You can tell me the story.
Well, what it was, the soldiers were in the field, and Lincoln wanted to have an election to show a semblance of normalcy to the country. But the soldiers in the field couldn't get back to their states to vote, so New York invented basically the mail-in ballot. But they said the soldiers had to have four witnesses: the power of attorney, the person who's going to carry the vote back, officer, and the person who signed it to begin with. Well, the Democrats got wind of how that was going, so they started writing in names, and they had a whole assembly of people that were doing the ballot. So they sent from New York to Baltimore to get those ballots, and they found that the Union soldiers had voted 400 for McClellan, who was basically a Democrat, he was a Southerner sympathizer. 400 voted for McClellan, and only 11 voted for Abraham Lincoln, but they were caught in this process of forging mail-in ballots. And in another state they were doing that. So this has happened before. It worked so well then, they almost got away with it. But now it's on a much larger scale.
Right. Well, I'll need to read up on that particular piece of history. It sounds very relevant to where we are.
Yeah. Best article I found was, I think it was on the Washington Post. So if you say Google mail-in ballot hoax Lincoln, that article should come up and has a lot of that information in there. All right. So here we go. Somebody asked, is it likely the red states would succeed if there was a secession? Red states versus blue states.
Yes, I think that's how it would go. I mean, it's a matter that, it plays out in different ways. If Biden succeeds in becoming the president of the country and or Harris, and they do what they say they're going to do, I think there will be considerable movement within red state America to get out. I'm not going to predict that would succeed, but the movement would be there. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. When the Pilgrims came over, I don't know if this is in the 1620 Project or you even address that. What Bible did they use?
No, I think I know, but I'm not sure, and I don't want to pass out misinformation, so
Okay.
I'm gonna have to pass on that one.
Okay. Now, because there's always, I always like to throw some controversy out there, so I'm going to throw one out now. Make a lot of people mad watching the show. Was there a time when the Puritans would fine people for celebrating Christmas?
I believe that's true, but be careful here. The Pilgrims and the Puritans are not the same group.
Right. That's why I said Puritans, not the Pilgrims.
Yes, I believe that that's right.
And
There
then
was a strong opposition to ceremony and ritual within the Puritan movement, and
Now they, and it's because I believe they considered Christmas pagan. So that's going to make a lot of people mad right there, me even saying that. Hey, you know, if you're going to look at history right in the face, you got to look at it, you know. Now, I have
Well,
great respect for the Pilgrims and the
I'm
Puritans.
an anthropologist again, and I mean, I know full well that when the Christian missionaries were spreading Christianity to the pagan peoples of Europe, they did what missionaries often do. They tried to accommodate local culture. So the use of ornamented trees to celebrate the winter solstice was well spread through Northern Europe, and as it happens, the Christian missionaries just shifted the date a little bit, but and redefined what the trees were all about. But there is a pagan root there, and the Christmas celebration is, at least to some extent, a redefinition of the winter solstice ceremonies of pagan Europe. The Bible doesn't tell us Jesus's birth date, so it gives us that flexibility to imagine what date we want, and that's
Right.
how it ended up.
Okay. Question for you then from the live chat. But Yahweh first says, Peter Wood, why do they deem the U.S. Constitution so offensive?
I think it's viewed as the work of slave masters trying to create a system that will perpetuate their own power over the weak and unfortunate. They view the American Constitution as compromised from the get-go by the unwillingness of the framers of the Constitution in 1787 to abolish slavery outright. It's a document that did not grant the voting franchise to women. It still had property rights as a prerequisite of voting. There's many things that were conceived as legal and important in the American founding that were later amended out of existence or just ceased to be applicable. So the Constitution can be viewed as an obsolete document at best, or at worst, a recipe for a kind of tyranny that made
Wow,
room
can you
for
imagine a could you ever see a constitution-like document coming out of CHOP?
that.
So, thou shalt smoke weed and firebomb thy neighbor. I mean, I don't know what it is. By the way, our astute, I guess it caused, like I like to cause controversy. I guess it erupted in the live chat, Peter Wood. Some people are saying that it was the Geneva Bible, and then other people said they didn't trust the King James Version. So now we got a big fire going on, which I love to start because, you know, I can just start them and walk away. It's great. Hey, but let me tell you something. This is interesting. Now, we got a big day coming up, December 14th, right?
We do.
It's a big day. It's Monday. And of course, that's when the electors elect somebody. But on that day, there's going to be a comet, a meteor shower, and an eclipse all on the same day. Now, that leads me to this question here. It seems to me that the celestial elements are rebuking what may happen on December 14th, saying that this is bad news, like a bad omen. So that leads me to this question here about the Pilgrims, the 1620 Project. In any way, do you feel like they went through things that were providential, that they had the hand of God on them, that was undeniable that it's the hand of God, or do you think there's just conjecture or maybe feeling or something like that?
Well, I'm going to answer that in two ways. I'm the president of a secular organization, the National Association of Scholars, and our members are of all faiths and probably some of no faith. So there is no National Association of Scholars answer in this, but I'm answering it as Peter Wood. Yes, I think the hand of Providence was on the pilgrims, and that the utterly remarkable things that happened to enable that group of people to succeed clearly wasn't just happenstance or coincidence. No, they landed in a place that had been depopulated by a plague. They didn't bring the plague, but it had opened a space where they could land and not meet immediate hostilities. Within about 5 months of their landing, in walks this Native American, never seen him before, says, "Welcome, welcome, Englishman," mm-hmm. in English.
Right.
And they were floored by that. Well, it turns out that there had been enough contact with the outside world that some of the Native peoples spoke some English.
Mm-hmm.
But it was through that man, Semeset, and later on others who enabled the pilgrims to learn how to live in this place.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the hand of Providence, I can't think of any better way to put it. I think that's
yeah.
right.
I think you talk about Squanto, and what happened was he was taken to England as a slave, as some of them were, because originally whole tribes were wiped out by disease brought over by the traders, but some of them were taking slaves to England, and he was one of them, but he made his way back, and yes, mm-hmm. you're right, he did teach them, and I guess that's where we get the first Thanksgiving, because he told them how to plant corn and various where good hunting was, and so that was kind of providential there. I mean, there, as I said many times on this program, there's a book out there called The Providential Life of George Washington, where they delineate a whole list of acts that just are beyond coincidence. And so I was just wondering if you thought the same thing with the pilgrims. But now that brings us to today. Do we still, if there were ever legitimately providential intervention in America, could we surmise that we may get one today, or maybe December 14th, or maybe in the future?
I wouldn't surmise that we will. I mean, it's a just God who punishes and rewards as he sees fit. We are a nation that has committed some pretty terrible acts in the last couple generations. So I know Christians who think a chastisement is coming, others who are hoping for forgiveness and a benevolent act on the part of God. I wouldn't presume to know which way God is going to judge us, but I would say whichever way he does, it's going to be ultimately fair, and maybe we're going to have to endure some even worse things before we see something better.
Mm-hmm. Benjamin Franklin said, "The older I get, the more I'm convinced that God rules in the affairs of men." And it does seem that as people get older anyway, they gravitate toward, well, maybe I need to, you know, clean my life up and start seeking out this benevolent God, see if I can get some mercy here, because I don't know where I'm going. But this country doesn't seem to know where it's going. There does seem to, we do seem to need providential, I don't want to say interference, but maybe guidance of some kind. But would you like to say what you think the American sins are in the last couple generations, or you want to leave that one alone?
Well, I would say our permissive attitude towards abortion rates pretty high up on my list of our national sins. There are others as well.
Now, there are, when it comes to the biblical, so I don't know what you would call it, judgment, I guess. When you look at Sodom and Gomorrah, there was some bargaining going on where Lot was saying, hey, you know, if there's 10 people in here, you know, is there 50 righteous, would you destroy it? Is there 20? He started bargaining with God, got all the way down to 10. And I don't even think there were 10. But not everybody in this country, at least half the country, doesn't like that abortion is happening. So how do you think Would you think God would judge the nation as a whole, or would you think he could tailor make some of that judgment to those that are really? And I bet you, Peter Wood, I'm going out on a limb, and I'm making this declarative statement that these types of people that's causing this strife go all the way back to the strangers. Okay, I'm just putting it out there. Okay, because they're the ones that said, hey, we want to celebrate Christmas. Hey, we want paganism. Hey, we want slavery. Next thing you know, they're stealing elections. So they've been coming through time. But anyway, that's me. You didn't agree to that. I just said that's what I'm thinking. So is it possible that there could be a separate sort of judgment to those that are really into that kind of thing?
Well, of course there could be. I am just not going to put myself in the pulpit here and tell you what God's will is on this.
Right, right.
I think God's will is supreme and sovereign and will reign. If he chooses to make all of us suffer for the sins of others, but you know, we all have our own sins as well. So I'm not going to.
Hey, you know what? Here's the hope I cling to, because the Bible says, if it weren't for the grace of God, we'd all be destroyed. There's not exactly one righteous among us, no, not one. And I certainly am not one. So I do count on grace, God's grace, and it does seem that his grace was imparted to America in 1620, and that he had chose every one of those pilgrims and even the strangers to come over. Maybe he gave the strangers a chance to look and see how righteous people or people that are dedicated to the Lord, you know, act and behave. Maybe give them the first view of that, because like you said, some of them wanted to stay, although at a certain point the people on the ship, the captain, the crew at some point say, hey, we're done with this. We're just dump the supplies off and get out of here. That at some point they had that discussion just to leave them. But some God's grace maybe kept them there as long as they needed to be. All right, more questions coming in. Getting near the end of broadcast, but let's go ahead and take a couple more here. It says, do you think it may come to citizen militias having to form to protect basic freedoms and protection of rights?
Well, I want to say yes to that. I fear that this is going to get kicked up and broadcast around the country that I'm endorsing violent self-help as the answer to our political problems. I don't endorse it, but I do think that those militias already exist, and it's not a good idea to go around with policies declaring that the Second Amendment is going to be treated as null and void, or that the government's going to be able to tell us to shut down all our businesses and wear masks forever. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff is poking a hornet's nest. Mm-hmm. And it surprises me that the Democratic left doesn't realize just how dangerous it is for them to be playing up to some of their most extreme constituencies by floating those ideas.
Well, that could be, because if you got a bunch of latte drinking, skinny jean wearing, skateboard driving people come up against the righteous anger of of Americans that believe in the Constitution, I don't think they're going to fare well.
Oh, I agree. They're not going to fare well. Probably more than you, I see the latte drinking, skinny jeans wearing people all around me almost every day.
What is that like, Peter, when you see that? Do you think, oh my gosh?
Well, you mean, to survive in New York City as a conservative means to be able to adopt a certain degree of camouflage. I don't go after people. I observe and I take notes and I understand what's going on. I mm-hmm. feel very sad that so many of my neighbors, let me give you context here. I live in the zip code that is AOC's largest fundraising catchment area. Mm-hmm. We give her more money than her own congressional district does. Mm-hmm. So I know who my neighbors are, and I'm, let's say, cognizant that they represent only a relatively small minority of real America, but they're completely complacent in their own view of things.
They live in their imaginary world, I think.
I walk outside all the time without wearing a mask, and typically the only person on the street without one, and I get very hostile stares from people.
Right.
But
right.
I have not ever been assaulted or anything like that, so I can bear those ugly looks. That's a small price to pay for freedom.
So there you go. There's a tie-in right there. So not wearing masks now really is the equivalent of not paying the tea tax.
Exactly.
You're refusing to pay it. And, of course, you're looked down upon. I mean, only 25% of Americans wanted to revolt against the British Empire because they offered safety, continuity, tea, and things like that. They didn't want to. So only 25% of the rabble-rousers. And apparently, Peter Wood, you just might be one of those 25% that still exists today.
That's possible.
I think we've unmasked you on this program. So I guess you were talking about you were walking very slightly on the militia question. So I guess I should never say anything about the Tree of Liberty should be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. I shouldn't use that quote either on this program, should I?
No, not in my presence. They might be offended.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't want any harm to come to you either, of course. By the way, here's a comment about you. It says, what a great guest. Peter Wood seems to be such a thoughtful, intelligent man. He has mastered his tongue, doesn't blurt anything out. Accomplishment in itself. God bless you. Of course, me, on the other hand, I blurt things out all the time and stir up trouble. I don't know if I didn't give you like a disclaimer to come on the program, but I don't think it's that bad, though. All right, another question for you. Do you feel that this country is under God's blessing still at this time, or have we gone too far? We kind of addressed that question a little bit already. You know, I'm looking, we're not destroyed. We're still here. And, you know, this country made it through 8 years of Obama. And I don't even, you know, one thing I noticed about that tyrant, the only thing I noticed was higher gas prices and something to do with healthcare, something about healthcare out there. I didn't know what that was. I mean, isn't that the way, is it going to be like that again, or is it going to be worse if that happens? If you know who gets, you know what?
Well, I think it's going to be worse. I think there were things that the Obama administration planted that he didn't have time to harvest because Hillary didn't make it in. But Biden is bringing back the old team, and they tend to move right ahead with them.
I've seen there was a group picture of that team. They are the saddest, angriest looking people you ever want to see. You know, I think they're mad because other people in the country are happy, and they don't like that.
No, they want people to be grim and willing to buckle under. You know, I can give examples of policies that Obama was trying to put in place and didn't quite get there. There was this affirmatively furthering fair housing, I think was the name for it. But the idea there was to force the suburbs to join in the cities and flood them with Section 8 housing and stuff like that. It was an attempt to make sure that the suburbs got turned deep blue. It's already had some success, but Biden is going to go right on with it. In the world that I spend most of my time on, higher education, Obama gave us this Dear Colleague letter, which was to weaponize Title IX and force colleges and universities to adopt essentially to abolish due process for anybody accused of sexual harassment. And fortunately, the Trump administration was able to unwind that. And we now have, just recently, as of August, a new set of regulations that do away with at least the worst parts of that Obama-era regulation. Biden has said that it's going to be among his first acts to restore what Obama did. Those are maybe small things, depending on what your concerns are, but they're just part of a long, long list of policy initiatives. Americans usually have a pretty hard time paying attention to policy because it's boring, really. But once you do start paying attention to it, your eyes open up and you realize policy is really where tyranny gets enacted.
Yeah, I call it Jeb Bush boring when I see some of these policy questions, and it'll get no bo more boring than that right there. And it's but let me ask you something. You kind of hit the point there that Trump was not supposed to win. Every poll had him down by crazy margins. He came out of nowhere, had no experience, beat them all. Isn't there something providential about that, Peter Wood?
Yes,
Or is it
I'll just leave
blind
it at
luck?
that. Yes.
So if that was providential in any sense of the word, and the providence didn't go away, that providence is still there.
Well, I said we can count on God's mercy, but you can't presume against God, so we
Yeah,
don't know.
I don't ever presume either. I know exactly what you're saying on that there. 1620 Project. What can people learn from that? I got a website linked directly to it, the 1620 Project, which looks like it's part of the National Association of Scholars. What people get from that?
Well, I think what you can get from it, if you want to have it, is a deeper understanding of how the American left is strategizing against the rest of the country. This effort to demoralize America, to make young people especially hate their country, is a well-worked out plan. The New York Times' 1619 Project was a clever and very well financed effort to advance that part of their game plan. I use past tense there as it was, but it is. The Times has spent a lot of money. My estimate's well over $10 million to publicize this. They orchestrated her getting Nicole Hannah-Jones getting a Pulitzer Prize. So all the establishment instruments have been lined up to promote this thing. What you get out of reading a book like mine is a fairly readable account of how all those pieces fit together, what they were doing, but it's also put into the framework of reminding us that we have another story to tell, that if you really care about the origins of the country, and I think we all should, a better place to start is with the arrival of the pilgrims. It's easy for me to say that in a few words on a podcast or on radio, but the details do matter. And I've written a book where I try not to overwhelm people with details, but to make it vivid enough you can read the book and then talk to other people and do your best to convince them. When I say other people, that's broad enough, but the other people I'm most concerned about are young people. This is a time when you have to trust that the schools are doing the wrong thing, and it's going to be up to parents and the rest of us to counter those pernicious messages with better messages. You can't do that unless you know the story yourself. If you're of a certain age, like you and me, we grew up with these stories and we know them. Maybe we've just let them rest in the background of our lives and not thought about them very much since. Now's the time to think about them, do some reading, be able to tell the story. The cartoon version of the pilgrims as these pointy-hatted people who got off the Mayflower and cooked some turkeys with the Indians or something like that, it doesn't do justice. There is a dramatic, really compelling story here that anybody can learn to tell, and we should learn to tell it, and we should repeat it.
Well, like I was saying on that, they came to a land where there was no buildings. It was a, actually, I think it was an Indian settlement at one time, but they were all killed off. And so, and it was freezing cold, and they, I mean, they were coming across the ocean with the mortar that held the ship together would continually pop open, and seawater would come in, and so many of them were sick on the ship from the cold water, and they had to continually fill that up, and so they were sick coming across there, yet they persevered, and then they came to a place with a vast wilderness surrounded Indians out there, no nothing to eat, nothing to do, no shelter, and our 1620 is sort of right now, and in 2020, because we're at a place where there is no shelter. People come against us. They're out in the woods. They're out there making their plans against us. We have to have the same vigilance and the same heart and the same drive and the same faith that drove them to say, we're making our stand here on this land. We're going to dedicate this land. We will persevere. And they did against all odds. And that's the story that we can learn from them and apply it today, because that DNA is still in us, the American DNA, Peter Wood.
Well, I agree, and I hope it prevails, because it's got a scary situation to deal with. Remember, nearly half those people died, so it's not
So
going to be costless to win this.
there were some casualties. But let me tell you something an old time preacher once told me. He said, hoping is not faithing.
All right.
So you and I are going to bind together, have a little faith. Peter Wood, I appreciate you coming on the Edge television broadcast. What do you think about this interview?
I liked it a lot. Thank you much. And I did blurt out a lot of things that I don't normally say, but that's okay. I think I had a great conversation with you. You raised questions that I welcome and I don't often get asked.
Oh, good, 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 good. Yeah, I know you're probably get tired of looking at a green screen here, but that's not what's going on back here. I'll send you the links after the show is uploaded on YouTube, and there's a permanent link. They'll be on the website. It'll be up in iTunes as well. Peter Wood, I appreciate you coming on the Edge broadcast. Can we have you on again sometime?
Absolutely. Anytime you like.
Now, this is like a safe harbor for you. You sailed into the Edge Harbor. It's a safe harbor here.
Okay.
And we're going to get more out of you next time. You've been holding back, and I think there's more that we got to know.
Oh, maybe, maybe not. I'm not trying to be deceptive.
No, not at all. Peter Wood, thanks for coming on the show.
Okay. Thank you much for having me.
You bet, sir.
Good night.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. That was...